Welcome to Surgical Hot Topics, a podcast series from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. This podcast features leaders in cardiothoracic surgery discussing timely issues important to the profession and their patients. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual participants and not necessarily that of STS.
Thank you for joining us for this STS video roundtable discussing the expanding the donor pool management of high-risk donors. My name is Zachary Kahn. I'm a heart and lung transplant surgeon from NYU in New York, and it's my pleasure to introduce our panel.
My name is Ashish Shah. I'm a chairman of cardiac surgery at Vanderbilt Medical Center.
My name is Matt Hartwig. I'm a donor thoracic and lung transplant surgeon at Duke in Durham.
I'm Varun Puri. I'm a thoracic and lung transplant surgeon at the Washington University in St. Louis.
So just to get things off, I think it's important to define what we're actually talking about. So Dr. Shah, would you mind telling me what you think of when we say high-risk donor? What does that actually mean to you?
Yeah, I think that that is really a definition. It's an evolution, frankly. I think that we established what is considered a high-risk donor a long time ago based on really just the gut instincts of real pioneers in this field. And I think that over time, however, we've had the ability to characterize donors in different ways. And so, you know, now to me, I think that a high-risk donor is as much a donor that may have some high-risk features like age, like distance from your transplant center, left ventricular hypertrophy, and this is just in the area of heart transplant, but also it's how that donor interfaces with the recipient, I think is really a more sort of 21st century look at this, because I think it is very clear that it's not just about a donor and their particular risk profile, it's how their risk profile interfaces with recipient characteristics. So it's a little bit of a definition evolution, but I think there are certainly basic biologic things like age and what you predicted ischemic time is to think are at risk. Maybe the second thing is to define what risks we're worried about. Is it about death of your recipient? Is it about long-term allograft dysfunction in recipient? So those are the two things that I think about when I think about risk.
Now, what do you think some of the innovative and newer ideas on how to either mitigate those risks, whether it's mortality or morbidity, of recipients when using these high-risk donors? And again, that definition is fluid. Where do you see us currently and where do you see us going?
Yeah, I might take a second just to get on my soapbox and comment a little bit on the terminology. I think we all know what we're talking about in this situation when we talk about high-risk donors, but I think for a lot of people who don't do this every day, there may be some confusion or concern around what that term means. You know, some of it is around the old CDC high-risk definition of high-risk donor and now increased risk donor. Some of it is around nomenclature that may sort of increase the concern either the public or the lay press has around trying to maximize donor utilization. And so I know the title of this sort of discussion was around high-risk donors, but I've really tried to move away from the term high-risk donor and try and focus on sort of what is an acceptable donor or not. And, you know, as Ash mentioned, that can depend a little bit on the recipient and how the recipient matches with the donor. And so I think one thing that we can do to try and mitigate, you know, the risk of using donors that don't necessarily meet ideal criteria is this concept of really looking for how the recipient and the donor are going to work together for the best outcome. And there are some donors that may be perfectly suited for a young, otherwise kind of healthy recipient, and others where you may want to avoid them in kind of the older or sicker or higher risk recipient. So that's, I think, one just commentary around the definitions we're using and the terms we're using, and then, you know, one of the ways that we can try and mitigate some of these challenges that we face in maximizing the use of donors.
So not to replace one bad term with another, but maybe marginal donor or extended criteria donor is, I think, more the topic here. But again, your point is well taken that it's really that interaction with the recipient and that this may not be an extended criteria or marginal donor for the right recipient. It should be a acceptable donor for that recipient, and I think that's an excellent point. Dr. Puri, what do you think in regards to the OPO's role in managing, improving, making diagnostic testing available that we can make that determination of, is this a good organ that we can ultimately use for the right recipient?
I think that's the OPOs play a critical role in both managing the donors, improving quality of the donor organs if that's at all possible, and then appropriately communicating that information to the recipient institutions. So that interplay that has been talked about between the right donor for the right recipient can actually be worked out. And as the nation is divided into over 50 OPOs, all of which have different management styles, we suffer from lack of uniformity in that regard, both for heart and lung donors. And unfortunately, when you look at thoracic organ donors, the likelihood of getting organs from a brain dead donor is much lower than that of other solid organs. So for kidneys and livers, that utilization rate for organs is in the range of 60 to 90%. For lungs, nationally, it's about 22 or 23%. And data from Matt's institution has previously shown that there are many organs which are utilizable but are eventually not used for transplantation. So I think that OPOs, and we are at our institution, have been fortunate to work with a very forward-thinking and progressive OPO that has made contributions both scientific as well as policy-based in this regard. As an example, our OPO built a specialized donor care facility about a little over 10 years ago. And at that point in time, they hired a critical care pulmonologist to run the intensive care unit at this OPO. And then they instituted a certain lung protective management algorithm. And then they went ahead and looked at the lung utilization rates prior to and subsequent to the utilization of the algorithm. So prior to that, the OPO's lung utilization rate was the same as national averages, 22 or 23%. And then subsequently, over a period of time, we could see an uptick, and eventually now they stand in the mid-35 to 40% range for lung utilization rate, which I think is higher than probably most OPOs in the country. By utilizing simple, common sense lung protective management strategies which are used every day in taking care of sick patients in the ICU. Similarly, I was in conversation with the CMO of that OPO a few weeks ago, and they have two current protocols which are ongoing. One of them is looking at prone ventilation, and he shared some early preliminary data with me, which shows that this is a strategy which could be expanded further to recruit lungs and improve the quality of marginal donors. So there's a lack of scientific literature in this domain, which is rather unfortunate, but we need forward-thinking OPOs and collaboration between transplant centers and OPOs to fill that void and generate evidence which will actually help us manage these donors.
Can I ask you a question there? Sure. I mean, that number has persisted. That is, the lung donors in this 15, 20%, and we've got high-performing OPOs and low-performing OPOs. Why have we accepted this variability in OPOs? Why haven't your practices, what do you think the barriers are, really, for all the OPOs to behave the same with respect to things that we know seem to work for improving organ yield?
That's a great question. Thanks for lobbing it to me. As a matter of fact, we have a study which is currently ongoing, in which I'm collaborating with dissemination and implementation science. And I'm proud of myself for being able to say that term in one phrase. There are experts in that domain who are helping us understand the barriers to utilizing this lung protective management nationally. So we're conducting a study, and eventually all OPOs will be participants in that study, where we are trying to see what specialized barriers there are at each individual OPO. Some of them are lack of knowledge, but others, as we are performing the study, we find that there is continued use of historically handed down information as this is how you should manage the organ donor without any evidence to support those practices. And hopefully with better information dissemination, as well as showing them the data, we will have people who will utilize these lung protective management algorithms, and I'm sure there are data in the cardiac domain also that exist in that regard. So that is just a challenge that we face nationally, but I think that it's something that we can overcome because if we expand the donor pool, that in itself will lead to mitigation of a significant part of that organ shortage that we have.
Should we be harder on the OPOs? This is the very, nice version of that. I mean,
well,
what do you think,
yeah,
Matt?
I mean, it raises the question a little bit around the recent CMS announcement around changing some of the metrics that they're going to be looking at for the OPOs, and then holding the feet to the fire a little bit in terms of trying to maintain upper 25th percentile in terms of outcomes. Mm-hmm. And trying to put some true threat into losing your accreditation and subsequent payments if you don't maintain these. You know, I think to date there has been no repercussions for those who underperform or overperform. But I mean, overall, right, I think all the OPOs are trying to do the right thing, just like all the transplant centers are trying to do the right thing. And sometimes it's just a lack of knowledge and information and experience. So ideally this dissemination project will be fruitful. But we see tremendous variability on the OPO side, and even more variability if you look just at the increased risk or extended criteria donors, right? Those non-ideal donors show greater variability than the ideal donors. But we also see that amongst ourselves, and by amongst ourselves, I mean amongst transplant centers. So all of the moving parts of a transplant center, whether it be surgeon or pulmonary or the ORs or all of these things, there's tremendous variability in our utilization rates of these organs.
Do you think there's a significant component of scale there, that if we consolidated some of the OPOs into larger conglomerates, that we would do better than the 50 or so OPOs that we currently have?
Great question. Do you have a...
I have some thoughts on this, which is my personal thoughts. I'm not talking about from my institution or OPO's perspective. I do think that this would help, because if you have good practices which are difficult to disseminate and implement across a number of providers who come from different backgrounds, it's probably better to consolidate into fewer organizations which can universally implement those great practices and provide better outcomes for the donor population as well as the recipients who get these organs. And also, from my limited learning of the knowledge of the financial aspects of how this works, the OPOs are actually financially incentivized to have a higher performance. So their entire financial model rests upon having a higher utilization rate of organs. So I think that it makes
the variability even more puzzling then.
Yes.
Because they do have an incentive, to be sure. And I'm struck by maybe the other piece of this is the transplant centers, as you were kind of pointing out, and that your premise about regionalizing maybe also has some implications in how we manage transplant centers across the country. And I think they're high-functioning OPOs that are coupled with high-functioning programs, and they're probably really performing better than anybody, and then there's mismatches in terms of their missions. So
it's an excellent discussion, but shifting gears a little bit, where do you see us currently with ex vivo or in vivo technologies currently with assessing donor organs and deciding that this isn't a high-risk organ, this is a good organ that's going to work well for this specific recipient?
I can start by just talking about it. On the heart side, I think we're still in early days yet, unlike you guys on the lung side, where we're really first just understanding how to use the only commercially available technology that exists right now. We are still understanding the biomarkers that are involved in these non-working kind of ex vivo setups. So I think that they will play a significant role in how we manage some of these potential heart donors. The question is, are we going to use it to eliminate time, meaning match donors with better recipients, introduce HLA matching for the first time in thoracic transplant, which is possible, or are we going to use those platforms for purely reconditioning purposes? And I think that's why we're a lot further behind than the lung teams are on this front. So I think it's early days yet. We still have some proof of concept things. And the second piece is implementing them is a little trickier, because now organ preservation and recovery has to be professionalized. You have to have dedicated teams that are trained. There's a fair amount of capital outlay that's necessary. And is that sustainable, for most transplant centers? I think will limit the generalizability. Because on the flip side, a cooler of ice generally works. And it works pretty well. And we've done it for now, over 50 years. And that's, in some respects, the competing technology out there. So,
And what about on the lung side? Where do you see ex vivo technologies going?
The lung has a little bit more time under its belt and a little bit more experience and some other options in terms of not just having one device. But in reality, the rush to get approval and the rush to get onto the market, I think, has led to an environment where we've got devices that are really designed around an assessment period, an additional assessment period, but not this... not the dream of true rehabilitation yet on a reliable, you know, platform and feature. But it does, you know, I think Ash's point to the lung perfusion, at least, will potentially provide an opportunity to sort of change how we allocate and distribute organs. If you imagine, instead of all of the teams flying to the procurement center to do the procurement, eventually, what I would see happening is the OPOs are basically responsible for procuring the organs, getting them onto a device, and then allocating and sending the organs around. And that's going to change things. And we already have examples of being able to use these organs, or these devices, to move organs all around the country, right? I mean, we took a set of lungs from Hawaii and flew them to Durham on a device. And so, if you can get from Hawaii, you can get to Europe, you can get to South America. So all of a sudden the boundaries for allocation are shrinking with the use of these devices. And I think the whole paradigm of procurement hopefully is going to be changing before we, you know, retire.
Can I make a comment about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that the technology is fascinating, and it's great that as thoracic, and particularly in the field of lung transplantation, we're adopting it and utilizing it not just for cutting-edge research, but also in our daily practices. The one thing that we need to be careful about is the cost that the technology does introduce into our practice, and it's not cheap. It's tens of thousands of dollars per run on an EVLP circuit. So we, as guardians of in the field and good stewards of practicing cost effectiveness in medicine, we just need to be mindful about that.
We have a few minutes left. I want to change gears one more time and maybe just discuss a very underutilized donor group for lungs and until very recently completely non-utilized donor group for hearts, which is DCD donation, or DCD. So if Dr. Shah, you want to talk about heart side and maybe we can
Sure.
hear about the lung.
I think there's certainly a lot of excitement over utilizing these organs. I think that on the first part, it's worth exploring because it is a untapped number of organs that we can use. What the final number will settle out to be, you know, my prediction is that it's probably going to not be more than 10 to 20% of moving the needle on total volume. However, I do think it's a platform for us to learn a lot about how to resuscitate these organs, how to potentially unlock some secrets about hearts that are dysfunctional. So I think it'll be an important piece of a high-performing transplant center. I think it does introduce, as Varun was mentioning, some complexity with respect to cost, infrastructure, that we're going to have to manage. But I think the things that we're going to learn from it will be really, really important in the general field of cardiovascular medicine. So I'm pretty excited about what we're going to learn from it with a really sober view of how much we're going to change transplantation today with it.
Lung side?
Yeah, I mean, on the lungs, it's interesting. We actually have made progress. If you look over the last 5 years, the SRTR data, the rate of DCD is up from about 1.8 to 4.8%. So you could say it's, over doubled in terms of the use. But the U.S. is still very, very far behind Australia and other countries that have more established DCD. Programs. I think the talking about EVLP and DCDs, although we don't really need it for standard DCD lung donation, the big moving the needle forward sort of accomplishment would be truly getting uncontrolled DCD protocols and logistics worked out. You know, a number of people have been working on it. Tom Egan at UNC had NIH funding to do a trial in that at Toronto. I think Marcel and Schaff are doing some of that work. But the logistics in the U.S. are going to be hopefully not insurmountable, but very, very difficult to get that program up and running. But that would be, I think, a very large source of additional donors.
I completely agree. I don't have anything else to add to that.
Any additional thoughts or
I would just say that it's going to be it's an exciting time, I think, in transplantation, where some of the technologies that we have, some of the possibilities of marshalling large centers to do some really substantive work is really there. I do think it's interesting that we are all thinking a lot more about resources than we probably ever have in a field that's always been relatively rich with respect to reimbursement and latitude in the hospital system. So, as they say, may you live in interesting times, and I think it'll be very interesting in the next decade.
There have been several small studies recently of institutional experience with hepatitis C-positive donors into hepatitis C-negative recipients. Any experience that your institutions have accumulated in this regard, it'd be great to hear about that.
I mean, for us, so at Vanderbilt, we just essentially started just doing it. Mm-hmm. And as a model that did not involve randomized prospective trials, but really, I think it speaks to number one, you take an extraordinary thing like these drugs that cure people of hepatitis C, probably one of the most amazing human achievements of the 21st century is these drugs. You take desperate patients who need transplants and people saying, well, let's marry this concept together. I think it's been very gratifying to see it take off and to allow other centers to grow and to really kind of push the limits of what, you know, we're willing to do as, you know, as a field. But what I would say is that, you know, I think we've been able to show that it's safe. We've been able to show we can transplant people. I think to me it actually shows how hungry our patients are for us to find some solutions to this, you know, persistent, gnawing, and awful problem of end-stage heart and lung disease. And so I think it's as much a, it should motivate us. You know, what is that next technology or innovation like hepatitis C expansion that'll help us help more patients? That's what I've been more amazed about, how the consenting has been easy. The patients are like, absolutely. You know, anything is better than what I'm experiencing right now.
I think that point's really important that, again, whether it's 5%, 10%, whatever the increase is, it's certainly proven that we can make incremental improvements in what we're currently doing, and they can be widely successful. So if nothing else, it certainly serves that purpose. I think with that, we will close this roundtable. I'd like to again thank our esteemed panel for spending their time with us, and have a good night.
Thank you for listening to Surgical Hot Topics. If you like this podcast, please rate it and let your friends and colleagues know about it. More information about the Society of Thoracic Surgeons is available online at sts.org and on our patient website, ctsurgerypatients.org.